We never know what hits us, and then one day we're talking in falsetto.
Day, let me ask you something. How many pillows does Susan have on her bed?
About 12.
See? What is it with women and pillows? I mean, how many do you need? I mean, how many do you need? Two. One for you and one for her, right?
Yeah.
Vanessa has all these pillows. I mean, she's got round ones. She's got heart-shaped ones. She's got those pillows with the stuff around the edges.
Ruffles?
Yeah. You want to go to bed, you got to take all the pillows off. Then in the morning, you got to put them all back on. What is the point?
Marshall, Lifesavers is about to go under. I don't care about pillows. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm one of your curators, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator and partner in this journey into the cinematic universe of Mr. Adam Sandler, Sijan Sarawik. Sijan?
Thank you, Devin, and I am so pleased that you are here with me tonight, because I'll be honest, I don't know if I could go on this dark journey alone.
I agree cohesively with you right now, Sijan, because the journey we're about to take is mixed up, man. This is a mixed up episode.
I'm glad you dropped out, because you were starting to get into like a salesperson in an Indiana Jones scene that got edited out. Like, it was getting real weird.
Well, it just, you get that way when it's the holidays and you're sad. And I mean, we've done Uncut Gems. This is not the darkest Adam Sandler movie that we've looked at in our journey.
Nothing
into
ever will
into the
be
ASCU.
Since we've done Uncut Gems.
We have done Uncut Gems, right? I mean, until the next Safdie Brothers one, right? Which right here, Adam Sandler's just going to cut his hand off, and that's going to be the opening.
Yeah, but it's a comedy.
he's got us there, folks. Hi, welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. We are here to go through the filmography of Adam Sandler and build our own cohesive universe of those films, see what fits, see what doesn't fit, and then go on from there. You may know Sijan and I from our other podcast, The Say Report. That show is about everything. This one is about one very specific thing, the films of Adam Sandler. And you're joining us this December evening, 3 months after Adam Sandler's 56th birthday. I love that that's just something that's in my head now.
Oh man, did you see the like TikTok vid going around of Drew Barrymore giving him crap for being on the cover of AARP magazine?
Yeah.
I mean, actually, honestly, she wasn't even giving him crap. She was trying to be very celebratory. He just, you know, being him, wasn't taking any compliments.
I gotta be honest, when that AARP came to the house, I kind of stood outside in the rain looking at it for a minute like, oh wow, right? And then like I turned to dust slowly.
Yes, that piano music played as yeah.
No, I mean, it's cool. It's cool that he's there. He was on CBS Sunday Morning, which if that's not just, I mean, they call themselves a magazine, and it's a magazine for senior citizens, just like AARP. It's been interesting to see him because he is.
And we have to also, we'd be remiss if we did not also mention the other big internet presence he's had for the last few days, in which he has recently been reaching out to and then ended up doing a full on Variety 20-minute like back and forth interview with Brendan Fraser as well.
Yeah. Because Brendan Fraser right now doing The Whale. If you listen to the Say Report, we celebrate Brendan Fraser History Month every May over there. And since they work together in Airheads, a film that we haven't specifically covered, but we do have some alternate universe audio from.
And I will say, not a warning, but just a heads up, that because we here so fondly remember that film, the two of them don't necessarily.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying it's not with fondness. They fondly remember what they can remember.
Yeah, and also that's for the Brendan Fraser cinematic universe, which is like, how do you do a Brendan Fraser cinematic universe, right? Adam Sandler makes sense. Brendan Fraser, I like what the meta commentary that's going on right now. My brain hurts.
I just want to see School Ties team up with George of the Jungle to fight crime. Like, that's where I want that first crossover.
The best
Brendan
part
Fraser
is
Civil War.
So David winds up in the woods. This is not Adam Sandler content, just like for the record. But David winds up lost in the jungle, and he just looks out at all the animals, and he does his one superpower, which is yelling cowards when he is
cowards.
And then George of the Jungle swings out and hits a tree, and then they have that moment where they're studying each other. And like,
well, this is the part where I get to now remind you, and as you tried to remind yourself and didn't heed, but also our audience, that this is a much more focused show.
Yes, this is the focus show. So if you like this little teaser of what kind of things go on over at the Say Report, check it out. We drop a new episode every Monday, as opposed to this one, which is far more cultivated. So we can only do it monthly. Otherwise, our powers will just run out. And also,
we depend on a lot more editing monkeys for this one than we do for the other one.
That is a very true statement that Sijin just made at Christmas time. He can't lie at Christmas time. He'll put on the naughty list. And what we're doing, what we've done all season. Now, I want to finish up the fact that, like, Adam Sandler's been in the news. He had that interview with Brendan Fraser. There's Oscar talk from The Hustle. Like, this is an important time to be looking at the Adam Sandler stuff. But even more than what CJ and I usually do looking at the Adam Sandler stuff, this entire season, our entire fourth season, has been a season for the fans. And we have been looking at films specifically suggested and recommended to us by you, the listeners at home. So this is our finale of season four. Thank you for joining us. A quick reminder of the other films that we've looked at that you've demanded that we finally look at. We started off with Big Daddy, and then we stayed in New York for You Don't Mess with the Zohan. And then we continued our time in New York with Rain Over Me. Followed up Rain Over Me. We zigged instead of zagged. And went down to, it was California, is where Bedtime Stories takes place, right?
Yes, I do believe so, yeah.
I have completely blanked Bedtime Stories from my mind in just so many ways. But Bedtime Stories was our fourth episode this season. And then last month, we were back in New York celebrating the cobbler. We put ourselves into another person's shoes. Luckily, I'm a 10.5. I can't speak for Sijin's shoe size. At this point, I'd love him to reveal that he wears like a size 18 shoe, and I just never knew that.
Let me put it this way. I have to special order from Michael Jordan's Special Bigfoot magazine.
Which Adam Sandler was also on the cover of, right?
I'm sorry. I said I have to order, but I like to order.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. That's different. Having
that's
and liking
very different.
Are two different things. And
Frosty
now
the clown shoes going on over here.
And now going back to California with our final episode of season four for the fans.
Oh, we went back to New York and we realized it was starting to get to be winter. And who wants to spend winter in New York?
No one wants to spend winter in New York.
So we fucked
right?
off back to California. Yeah.
I mean, luckily, while we were in New York this past November, it was unseasonably warm. But yeah, I want to be in California. I don't want no snow on the ground. I want it to feel like any other day in Venice Beach. So that's why we're here. We're looking at Mixed Nuts. Mixed Nuts being the film that everybody kind of looked at me dumbfounded when I said I did an Adam Sandler podcast and last December and then told them we were doing 8 Crazy Nights. They kind of gave me this slack-jawed stare and said, well, why wouldn't you do Mixed Nuts?
And I think I know why everybody said that, Dev.
I yeah.
Because while both movies were not necessarily critically or financial successes, this one was playing a much more dangerous game with a lot more important people involved.
That is.
So I have a funny feeling that more people are kind of culturally aware of this one than 8 Crazy Nights. Again, not because of any type of artistic success or financial success that this one has that the other didn't, but rather just there was a lot more on the line this time around.
I mean, and then at the same time, it feels like there's nothing at stake. There's nothing on the line with this film. This film is a juicy contradiction in my eyes.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the big things that you need to remember, that we need to remember as audiences when we watch a movie like Mixed Nuts, is that sometimes people that make movies just want to make movies. I think to the point that you're saying is that it feels like there's really not much at stake. I think it's a very low stakes movie for everyone involved to be making, except for Sandler, because this is such a big breakout moment for him, but that doesn't mean that he in any way like overshines anything or he's like resentful or anything like that. It's very clear when he steps on screen, he feels a little bit kind of out of place in this movie, right? So that's the first thing I will say. The other thing I will say is that I never get the impression like people are just having fun making this movie is what it feels like, and it's not much more than that. This movie ends up not doing well. Not many of these people ever work together again. That's kind of the worst kind of collateral damage to this whole thing. Is like it's a shame that we never got to see like Steve Martin work with Nora Ephron again after this, right? Because this is a Nora Ephron written and directed piece, hot off the heels of Sleepless in Seattle. But more to the point, the movie that she had just made a couple of years previously with Steve Martin was My Blue Heaven with Steve Martin and Rick Moranis, which I have actually seen that movie quite recently because it's a movie that I watch frequently. It used to be one of those ones that I would watch as a rental from nearby like all the time when I was a kid, like sleepovers. It was really good sleepover fodder because I felt like I was getting away with watching an adult movie, but there's really not much in My Blue Heaven that like a 13-year-old can't handle, right? So I have really fond memories of that one. And this was always kind of one of those ones that I always saw on the shelf, but we never rented, mostly because it was a Christmas movie, and who rents Christmas movies when it's not Christmas? But then on top of that, like my parents kind of got the gist that it was not well received at the time. I'm not going to make a judgment call on it yet. We'll talk more about that later, but it was not well received. So they were also, we're not going to waste their rental time on that, right? Like, 'cause that's time and money. So like Mixed Nuts was kind of one of those ones that was kind of mythically kind of out there. I saw it every now and then on like HBO, but like there was a good track record leading up to this of a lot of really good work from people. And that unfortunately does not come out in the final product of this movie.
Yeah, this film is the most vignette-y of all the films that I think we've looked at yet. Like, it is, because there are things that work. There are moments in this film that are firing on all cylinders, that are working in every possible way. And
There are
then.
so many pieces of this movie that are amazing comedy, just like beautiful work done by ensemble, like not easy to direct ensembles of people. Like there is definitely good work at all levels in this movie, but this movie is like its pieces are better than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, that is a very, very good way to put it. And honestly, I hope I'm not like eating up future material for the show, but I think this is our first Grains of Sandler episode that we're actually covering, where Sandler is clearly not the main guy in this film. We only get like a little sampling of him sprinkled throughout the film. He doesn't show up in this movie for 14 minutes. And depending on how you want to
And
look at the billing,
then disappears for 30 minutes, and then is finally in the third act of this movie, in the last 30 minutes of this
oh, I
movie.
mean, you say that there's he has one other very, very brief scene, 14 minutes after his first scene, where they're taking Felix to the vet.
Well, that's what I mean is I didn't even
And that
clock
doesn't even
that.
clock exactly. Like, that's what I was going for, though, for my notes thing, because I'm taking notes for an Adam Sandler podcast. So obviously, I'm like cued into the fact that he's either sixth or seventh billed, depending on how you want to look at it, because Steve Martin gets billing above the title and then the title. So does that make him he's the sixth billed actor, but Steve Martin then the title? I mean, that says something, right? That is very much saying, this is Steve Martin's movie. You're all just performing in it.
I mean, I will say that a lot of what you're getting at, though, is more contractual stuff than what actually happens on screen. That stuff is never necessarily dictated by actual screen time or importance to plot or any of that nonsense. And this movie does what good French farce ensembles do, is that everybody gets some just delightful moments. Some just get more than others, for sure. A lot more of the progress of the plot is all based around Steve Martin's Phil, right? Like, I mean, he is clearly the protagonist of this piece. But I mean, Sandler also gets some phenomenal moments in this movie. People remember him being in it, right? I think that's the important thing to come back to, is no matter how little or how screen time or importance you feel like he might play in this movie, there's a reason why people were constantly like, if you're doing Christmas and you're talking Sandler, Mixed Nuts is a great way to go. Especially because I think a lot of people think we do this show to shit on Sandler.
That
So I
is
could definitely see why they would be like, why haven't you done this one yet? It's like, well, come on.
Yeah.
Like, If you listen to the show, you know that's not the point, guys.
Yeah, there's that. And there's also the fact that, like, why wouldn't you start with eight crazy nights, right?
Yeah,
Round
I
off
know.
The year by celebrating, like, the biggest celebration that Adam has ever put out. It was strange. And it was also one of those really strange things because it felt like last Christmas. I got Whamageddon earlier today, so it still kind of hurts to say those words next to each other. But last Christmas, it's like Mixed Nuts had this weird resurgence, probably because everybody had like watched everything already the year before. Like the 2020 December, all we were doing was sitting at home. So everybody just had watched every Christmas movie. So when it came down to like, well, what should we watch? It's like, oh, well, there's this Christmas film that like is not very well known. It's got Steve
Mixed
Martin,
Nuts or The Ref,
Madeline
which
Kahn.
Depressing
Yeah,
Christmas
exactly.
movie do you want to?
Oh, I choose The Ref. Well, prior to what we learned about Kevin Spacey, I would have chose The Ref every day of the week and thrice on Sunday. But now it feels a little weird. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
But The Ref is one of my favorite movies. And it's insane to me to think that in 1994, The Ref came out and Mixed Nuts came out.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk more about what else was coming out around it for sure.
Yeah, once we get to...
But we got some other stuff we got to get taken care of first, right?
Yeah. So you know who we are. What we're doing here is we're going to watch all the Adam Sandler films. We're going to try to fit them all together into a cohesive universe. And then just like our first impressions on this film. This was the first time I had ever seen Mixed Nuts. I will admit that like without any problem. And the first time I watched it, admittedly, I walked away a little disappointed. Because of all these people coming out of the woodwork saying like, oh, it's an Adam Sandler film and it's a Christmas movie. You guys got to do it. You guys got to do it. I was expecting him to be a larger part of this film. And he really doesn't get to do much until the third act. And then in the third act, he's good. But again, he's very much like a Greek chorus in one actor is sort of the way that I look at him. And he's clearly having a blast. He's having fun.
You've already ruined my new do not ruin my bar.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
Try.
So that's the way I feel. But then the next day when I got home and I said I, you know, sat down with my family and I'm like, you know, that makes nuts. That's a weird movie there, huh? Like, I don't know how to feel about it. And they all sort of agreed, which made me think, oh, they must have seen this movie then, right? So then the next day I sit down with my notebook to do my like critical viewing, taking notes and all of that. And it kind of grew on me. I have to admit that Mixed Nuts the second time around, I really enjoyed my time with it. So then I went, I said, you know, I think maybe I judged it too harshly. And then the reveal from my family that, oh, we've actually never seen that movie. So I am now recording this episode. It's day three. And my family is upset with me. Is like the simplest way to put it, because I insisted they watch Christmas movies all December. That's what they do. You know, it's retired people. It's people who don't have to go to work. So what they want to do with their days while I'm out working is watch Christmas movies. And I asked them, do you know what you're watching today? And when they said no, I'm like, watch Mixed Nuts. A, so that I can have someone to check my synopsis, which I can't wait to share with you. But B, because you guys clearly have never seen it, and I think you should. I mean, spoilers for later on in this episode, possibly. I think this movie is worth watching at least once. Maybe twice, maybe three times. You know, give it one for Gaspar, Balthazar, and Melchior. You know, it's what the baby Jesus
There's one
would have
review
wanted.
On Amazon of a guy who said that he was forced to watch this because it was apparently like a wife's like family tradition to watch this movie. And he openly hated it the first time he saw it. But he said, you know, by about our 10th washing, this has really grown on me. So I'm going to buy this DVD. 5 stars.
You're not going to get any more truth than in the Amazon review section. That's just a fact. But yeah, so it grew on me, and they watched it, and you know, the response was, we didn't really like that movie, but thanks for giving us an opportunity to nap. And then I brought up those little moments that are just absolutely gorgeous, that are like perfect cinema sort of encapsulated in a little gotcha ball. And they had the fond memories of those scenes as well. So it was a really good litmus test. But I will say, as I entered the studio tonight, it was with some stares and some aggravation from the family for having them watch this film. But I think if they ever watch it again, and they probably never will, maybe they'll like it a little bit more. And who knows, in 8 more viewings, they'll buy the DVD. So how about you, Siegen? This was not your first time, right? You'd gone on the Mixed Nuts ride before.
Yeah, so
Universal.
after it kind of being this like mythical like movie, like no joke, I remember very specifically when there was a small video store in town that got bought out by Blockbuster. That happened to a lot of them, right? And when they got bought out by Blockbuster, it was the only time this ever came down. Up until that point, they had always had a Mixed Nuts poster in the window. So from like 1994 to what must have been like 97, 98, there was just always a Mixed Nut poster in the window. So like that is like this movie was the movie that was on a shelf that like we walked by multiple times and I never quite brought myself to rent it, or like it was always at the movie thing, right? So when I got into like high school and we all started just renting our own movies and walking over and doing our own thing for a while, like it was one of the first ones that I grabbed, like just watched one afternoon, and I had no idea what I was getting into, you know, like first of all it being you know, a farce, and I was not fully like in and on the kind of the bits there, right? But then how dark it gets, it just gets like insanely dark, and I found myself at that time very much into these kinds of movies eventually. But this had to be one of the very first ones I saw that really got this way, right? Like I have been like hunting down trying to find my copy of Death for Smoochie, like, because like that is to me like this like ultimate like dark comedy. Like Danny DeVito just goes like too far, and nobody really likes that movie because of how dark it gets, right? This movie is very close to that in my brain. Of like some of the shit that happens in this movie is just, I mean, fucked up.
Yeah, no, fucked up is a pretty good way to go.
And the thing is like, I love that, right? I don't know if I love that because of when I saw it in my life and it just brought me such like giddy joy as like a 13-year-old boy, like sitting there watching this movie for the first time and realizing that like, not only could movies do this, because I knew about like B movies and all, and you know, and slasher flicks and all that, but the idea that this was a Steve Martin comedy that had Adam Sandler in a small role, Liev Schreiber at that point, I was super into. You know, like there's a lot of people on display in this movie that I just couldn't believe this was the kind of movie that they would make, right?
Yeah.
Lo and behold, there's a reason why they don't make many movies like this. but it just blew me away, right? And so like I have this weird fondness in my heart for this movie just because of like I know it is when I saw it, and I know that it does not equal out to like a phenom. I will not sit back and try and defend like the merit of this film of being on anybody's like normal Christmas list. But if you're the kind of person that loves movies, if you're the kind of person that loves to kind of, you know, stretch your wings a little bit when it comes to holiday films, like I don't see any reason why this is not a runner-up for somebody's top 10. Like I if somebody was like, look, it'd be on my top 10, but I mean there's a dead body in it that you find out is a serial rapist, so like okay, I guess that's fair. Yeah, that doesn't go into the top 10 list for your Christmas films, right? But it's like you thought about it.
Pretty happy I'm not the only one who picked up that he was a rapist. And that's
it's mentioned more than once.
I know there's a beautiful little like 1-2 Freddy's coming for you like nursery rhyme about it that like worked for me, and all I could think the whole time is we're really underplaying the fact that he's a rapist by calling him the Seaside Strangler.
Right. I mean, like he is a psychopath and a murderer, but like there's another element to this that we're just kind of just toying with in this comedy.
Yeah, so I'm glad. I'm just like, oh, maybe she's just being like hyperbolic in that moment. But then I also think there's that beautiful sequence with Rita Wilson, who, by the way, is the last single billed person in this film, despite kind of being the female lead. I think we could have that argument, and we might later on down the line. But it is, she says that thing that they're keeping some things out of the newspaper the way that they do to like make it less scary for the people who are reading the news. And I'm like, so maybe unless you're living in Venice Beach, you don't know about the rape. Or maybe like they don't want to call him the Seaside Rapist because that'll make people scared.
Right.
Him just strangling some brunette women with long hair who are very beautiful, that's fine. Him raping those same long-haired brunettes who are very beautiful, Well, that the people, the tourist industry, it'd be like shutting down the beaches over 4th of July. And yeah. We cannot stand for that.
And like, let's talk about, no, we don't want to talk about numbers and stuff yet because no. We want to get through our description first, Devin.
Oh, we're going to. Sometimes we do the facts and
numbers
figures
first. No.
Well, I mean, like, you say that it's one of those movies. Usually we do the facts and figures before we tell the people.
Okay, then I can say what I'm about to say then. Yeah. That's all that matters to me. I just want to be able to speak.
It was a beautiful segment when you're like, I think you'll find out why this is not a beloved film. Why don't you give us the facts and figures on why, Sijin?
So the big thing to remember then about this movie is in addition to all of the weird stuff that we've already kind of hinted at being kind of in the bones of this thing, right, is that it's also the landscape that it's releasing to, like, Richie Rich comes out alongside it. Like, that's the family adventure comedy. Dumb and Dumber has been out for weeks before this, right? Like, there's Devin, you'd mentioned to me that there was 5 Christmas movies that year, right? So yeah. There's this one, we joked about The Ref already. Trapped in Paradise is the other one, the Nick Cage one, right?
The Nick Cage one, why wouldn't you focus on John Lovitz and Dana Carvey?
Like, well, right. It really is a three-piece. You're right. Yeah. It is.
I mean, the only reason I bring that up is because I've been following someone who's doing a bracket of holiday films. And today, of all days, the day that we're recording, they did the Battle of the SNL Christmas Movies. So they did Scrooged against Mixed Nuts. Now, first of all, one of those is going to win. And I don't think you have to have listened to the last 26 minutes of this podcast to know which one of those has the clear advantage. But like,
no, but Scrooged versus something like Trapped in Paradise is a much more interesting conversation.
Yeah, right.
In that regard, with the SNL of it.
Well, I think if we're talking about the SNL of it, why not the SNL of 1994? Put Trapped in Paradise against Mixed Nuts, because they're both like kind of dark comedies.
Yeah, Trapped in Paradise is not nearly as dark as
it's nowhere near as dark as Mixed Nuts, but it is. It's certainly not, you know, Happy Happy Joy Joy. I mean, though Happy
So there was so there's Trapped in Paradise, there's Mixed Nuts, there's The Ref.
Remake of Miracle on 34th Street with Mara Wilson.
34th, that's right. And then the big reveal for the 1994 Christmas season is this is the year where we get Tim Allen's The Santa Claus.
I cannot believe, like, it is, there are a lot of things that I just don't believe in regards to Mixed Nuts. One of them I am saving for a little bit later in the episode, but to think that The Santa Claus and Mixed Nuts were made and released in and around the same year blows my fucking mind. Blows it right away.
Yeah.
Because
The
Santa Claus feels like it's better shot. And granted, it's got Disney movie behind it. And Tim Allen at the time is one of the biggest names just like in people's mouths because of Home Improvement. So like it makes sense in a way that like they might have more money for it. But these do like I would guess that Mixed Nuts was made in 1984 compared to what is on display in something like The Santa Claus.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, part of that is because of the minimal set and all of that. Like, they really do, in true farcical fashion, they do stick to just one or two sets mostly. There are a couple of times where they go to some other places, but it's mainly you're looking at the same three rooms for most of the movie, right? And then, so that kind of adds to the whole idea of this movie feels cheaper. I won't say cheap, but cheaper. Then, you know, there's so much more focus on like acting and faces and all of that sort of stuff. There's not a lot of crazy stuff going on. Like the Santa Claus has a lot of action sequences. There's probably some really early cleanup version CGI in certain places, and, you know, things like that, that just aren't, they don't have any place in Mixed Nuts. So Mixed Nuts feels like a much more classical film in that regard. So, I mean, that's part of the disconnect for me is that we are talking about two hugely like casted, like there's the amount of money going into the Santa Claus and Tim Allen doing kind of a big breakout role for him, right? And then this movie that has this star-studded cast involved in it is like, it's crazy that these two attitudes about Christmas existed at the same time. Like, I think that's the big thing for me. And then that got me to wonder, did Mixed Nuts just come out at like the wrong time in the world, right? Like, if this had come out later in Nora Ephron's career, first of all, so that she had a little bit more of a playing field for people to kind of have some feelings and opinions about what they were willing to accept from her as a filmmaker, right? Because a lot of what we were talking about earlier was reactions to this being the first movie she makes off of the heels of Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's
Right?
very
But then on top
strange.
of that, the way that we kind of take in comedy and dark comedy and the ways in which that changes over the years. You know, I wonder if this had been like a 2005 movie, and you know, then it would have also probably had the benefit of almost feeling like an artistic indie almost in some ways. Like, oh, we didn't spend any money on sets or costumes or anything. We spent it all on cast, and we just put them all in a room for 3 days. And this is what came out the other end. You know, like one of those types of pitches. I almost wonder if it would have had a better sell in those kinds of markets rather than this, in which they're competing with the Santa Claus and Richie Rich, and I just the number of family movies that you could have gone to instead of going to this
I
the
mean, the other
upsetting
crazy thing is
Christmas
that
movie.
this is the last one to release. This releases the week of Christmas. So
Yeah,
you
yeah.
also have all of those other choices are either out there or you have already gone to see them. So like what is Mixnut should have been the one released in November to kind of like get you ready for Christmas. It shouldn't have been the last one released. And honestly, I can understand why they would do it when you look at the cast. Steve Martin, Madeline Kahn, Rob Reiner, like these huge names in comedy who are coming together, and most of them worked with Nora Ephron in some small way on Sleepless in Seattle or before. So it's like there's a proven track record here. Like if you're in marketing, there's a reason why we're saving the fucking best for last, guys.
Well, so it has to be this has to be kind of like a personal project of somebody's, right? Maybe
Oh,
Nora
I
Ephron's
think
or
it's
what?
Nora, because it's Nora Ephron and her sister, Delia, who write the
Yeah.
script.
So they adapt the script,
Yeah,
right? They adapt the script from Santa Claus is a Stinker, which is a phenomenal name, and I can't believe they didn't keep it. Yeah, but it's a the French name is, oh my
It
God,
does sound better in the French.
Le
La
Pierre
Pierre
Noël
Noël
est une
Odor. Yeah.
ordure. Yeah. But the idea is pretty simple in that regard. Like it is a French farce through and through. You have very specific character archetypes that are very like important to the form and things like that. You have like you know you have like the three room setup, and you can do like closed door jokes and things like that. You have mistaken identities, and those are on display in misidentities. You have which is. This is not going to forgive any of the stuff that we will eventually talk about with the character, but it is where a character like a transvestite on stage for a French farce becomes very kind of tropey because it plays into a lot of the misidentification humor that comes in French farces, right? So what is one of the easiest ways they can do that? Well, let's put a man in a dress on stage. Is it I don't love that answer. I'm just saying that is what happened in history.
Yeah, no, I mean, all I think is of the Birdcage when you consider remaking a French property for an American audience and
Right,
just
yeah.
and how that
And you know,
film is,
so and a lot of the story is actually even much darker in the original French version. I mean, like they straight up like divide up the body at the end and feed it to like zoo animals and things like that. Like it gets really dark
Yeah, they
in
have
the
that
French
nice little moment
version.
of should we cut them up and put them into different Christmas presents, which
Yeah.
yes, that's how it is, and then they all dispose of them in their own way. And there's that beautiful archer that actually borrows from that
Yeah,
as
yeah.
well. But yeah.
I think Felix as a character, I think comes off much worse in the French version. He is just a straight up violent drunk. Although I'm pretty sure that if it's a French farce, I have not fully read that one or seen it in any way. But I can almost guarantee you that he still ends up with the young like female by the end of it, despite the fact that he has proven to just be a terrible person because they're basically your young lovers, right?
Yeah.
It's a wild story, and yeah, so Nora and I believe it is her sister that end up adapting this one for screen. She directs it, gets somebody like Steve Martin on, who is no slouch himself when it comes to French farces. He ends up adapting a couple later on, including one of my favorite. Steve Martin adapts The Underwear, which is just this beautiful, like, one room farce about a young lady who goes out to see the king and can't see him in like the procession. So she climbs a tree and then in the process loses her underwear. And three men see it and instantly fall in love with her. And it's all about them fighting over like her advances. One's like an artist, one's a rich snobby dude, one's like an old man. Like it's a phenomenal like little script that
Hey,
he
when in
wrote in.
Rome. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. But yeah, so like this is something that is also really kind of close, I think, to his heart too in a lot of ways because of the what they're doing. So like I don't think for any second anybody walked into the room on this one thinking, well, this is fucked up, fine, let's do it. Like I think everybody was pretty well on board with the idea that they were going to make this work. It's just like I said before, like it doesn't really add up to a really cohesive, fun experience. Like if I talk about individual scenes, individual moments, there's just some phenomenal over-the-top melodrama from the likes of Steve Martin. I mean, Rita Wilson, who you mentioned earlier, who plays Catherine, right? No,
Yep,
is that
that's
the name?
correct. Yep.
Yeah, like the two of them having just some wonderful moments together of just over the top acting. And I think that's one of the other big things about it that probably rubs people the wrong way. And rightly so, we've moved on from that kind of acting. But there is so much melodrama on display in this movie. Like purposeful, self-inflicted melodrama that they pump into this, whether it's the acting or the directing or what. And I just think that a lot of people just hate that kind of acting, and they don't see it as a good choice if they even recognize it as an artistic choice. Most often people just attribute it to bad acting, and I hate it when that happens because like no, it's actually extremely good acting to act that bad is like kind of like the mentality you need to take with it. But that doesn't change people's minds or hearts, right? Like at the end of the day, if they don't like watching it, if they don't have fun watching it, if it makes them uncomfortable, then I just think it doesn't work, for a lot of people.
Oh yeah, and especially you look at and the only reason I know this is because I watched it on Peacock, and I got thoughts about Peacock, but this is not the forum for it. The Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 13 audience rating and a 47 critic rating.
Do you have that right, or is that the other way around? The other way around.
Is it the other
It's a
way around?
13. It's a 13 critic rating and a 47% audience rating.
So here's
No,
here's my horrible secret. I don't know the order in which they go. The one that looks like a splattered green tomato, that's the critic
well, the
rating.
one called audience score is
Okay.
usually the one provided by
So
the
they don't give
audience.
you that on Peacock. On Peacock, they just give you a
Oh, they
splatted
just give you the
tomato
image.
and the
Yeah.
number, and then they give you an empty popcorn, and then
So the
the
popcorn is the
popcorn is
audience,
the
and the
audience.
splat is the
Okay.
tomato meter,
Okay.
which is critics.
So yeah. So I definitely have that the other way, and apologies,
Yeah,
because
so
I
that's
didn't
the
realize.
big kind of yeah, well that's kind of the prevailing history of this movie, is that as far as like a normal day-to-day audience goes, there seem to be people out there that love this movie, and there seem to be people out there that hate this movie. Like the finding somebody in between is not hard, but even they will say I'm 50% on it. Like there's nobody out there that's like 7 out of 10. It's either a 0, a 10, or a solid 5. That's it for people on this movie. And that even goes true when you start looking at things on Google Play ratings and Amazon ratings. Is like it enjoys like a 4.5 like star rating on Amazon, but if you actually divide those out and read through them, the majority of the good ratings are that terrible thing that happens on Amazon all the time where their people are rating the movie. People can't decide if they're supposed to be rating the movie or the purchasing experience, and so that becomes a bit of a pain in the ass where people are like, I hate this movie, but it came in a day, 5 stars. It's like, okay.
The DVD menu is very engaging.
And I'm not even saying that there's a right way that either one of those is right. I don't even know if when I rate stuff, if I should be rating the product itself or the experience with which I purchased it. Yeah, but
You're supposed to rate the product. You're not supposed to rate the
critically,
experience.
I mean, but the problem is that if you're on like a third party buyer, then at that point, I don't care about the product. Like, I'm pretty set on buying this product. That's why I'm so far down the rabbit hole, right? At this point, I want to know about the buying experience because if you paid $50 for this and it didn't come for 6 months, I want to know that, right?
I mean, I get that, but I feel like the whole rating system is supposed to be based on the product itself. That's what Amazon designed it for. They didn't design it for you to. There should be two separate ones for third-party sellers.
Well,
But
And
Amazon.
as we
Look at
know,
what we've
Daddy
done.
Bezos sets all the rules for us here on these podcasts. So because Amazon designed it that way, that's the way we have to treat it.
You know what? While we're talking about ratings, if you're enjoying what you're hearing here at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, why not rate us 5 stars in the Apple Podcast Store? Or
Smash
wherever
that
you
like
listen
button.
To it. Smash it.
Subscribe.
Tell a friend. Right? If you tell 2 friends and they tell 2 friends, bye-bye, birdie.
You can even become a member of our channel. I don't know what that does for you because I haven't done it for anybody else, but you could try it.
You could be the first. But yeah, I think the one thing that I would like to address about everything you said is maybe this film is too early. I think this film hits at the perfect time. This film has a half-life, and that's an unfortunate thing about this movie. We can enjoy it now because of everything that we've been through, but if this film had come out had 7 years when it could have released, right, and probably been okay, right? But then when 9/11 happens and our whole worldview kind of shifts, like, Christmas becomes a thing to be happy about again. There's this real cynicism about Christmas that I remember touching the holiday as a kid growing up in the 90s. And that was like the thing I think I might have liked the most about this film is just that reminder of the fact that, like, oh yeah, we were kind of down on Christmas in the 90s.
I gotta remind you, and this is not to call
no,
you out in
please
front of
do.
Everybody.
I don't care, no.
The, like, number one Christmas movie of 2003 was Bad Santa.
Okay.
Like,
not
cynical,
Love Actually? That's
cynical
crazy.
Christmas
Those are both
movies.
2003. Love Actually is not more bigger, is not bigger than Bad Santa. That's
bad, bad Santa. Well, not anymore. Bad Santa. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's a retrospective thing, right?
Yeah.
But Bad Santa doesn't hit like Bad Santa hits. It doesn't go quietly into the night, right? Like whether you want to compare it to Love Actually or not, which is not the point. My point being, like, cynical Christmas, like, was something we loved. The Christmas, one of the very first episodes of The Office on both the British and the American version is a Christmas episode, and it becomes kind of like a lightning rod for that show and why people get attached to it as quick as they do. Like, we were into cynical Christmas just like we were into cynical everything. I think that you're right that there was definitely a group of people that really tried to protect Christmas over the years, and that group has broken off in various ways, whether it's the people that have turned away from Christmas because of consumerism or maybe have decided to take the war to people like Starbucks, which is a ridiculous way to go about it. But, like, I think that there is always, I think even after 9/11, and I think maybe some might argue even more so after 9/11, because of some of the stuff that happened, like, cynical Christmas has a place. I think maybe we were less likely to, it wasn't going to be, like, out there for everybody. You know, it would, this, if this had come out in like the late 2000s, it wouldn't have had this cast. It would have a weirder cast. It would have been a smaller release, and then it would have been a big, like, midnight showing on Comedy Central or something, right? Like, it would have been part of their late night movie thing that they did, where they premiered the Hebrew Hammer and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like this would have had a life after 9/11. It just maybe wouldn't have been the same one that it had before.
I don't know. It's just, I think about that, and I think maybe that's, I mean, I don't watch a lot of holiday stuff, and I think that this film really kind of awakened a lot of those thoughts in me. Christmas to me is the episode of Wings where Anthony, like, there has to stop a guy from killing himself by jumping off of a lighthouse. Like, he gets in his cabin and he's like, take me to the lighthouse, I want to kill myself. And that whole episode of Wings is basically about, like, suicide is up and all of these other things. Like, it's a this depressing episode of Wings that I watched at a very tender age. And, like, that's what Christmas is to me, is, like, I focus on, like, yeah, there's all this happiness, but there's a sadness to it. And
Whoa.
As I've grown, and I think probably Love Actually would be, like, the origin of seeing this, and then, like, just kind of following that path and just seeing where the consumer lands, because, like,
yeah,
movies try to emulate Love Actually a lot. I mean, look at what Gary Marshall does with the whole sort of, like, Love Actually inspired universe of things like New Year's Eve, Valentine's Day, and Mother's Day. like it becomes this thing to be sort of attained, these like big ensemble pieces that are basically Love Actually just set at different holidays. And I feel like that erased this. I feel like there was representation for the depressing Christmas in cinema pre Love Actually. And I think of Love Actually as this weird, like it's either 2002 or it's 2003. Cause I think they just did a 20th anniversary on it. And
it's 2003. Love Actually is a 2003 movie. You. It's just that. So, I mean, you want to talk about depressing Christmas movies, depressing that one of the most people would put the number one Christmas movie on their Christmas list would be It's a Wonderful Life. And that's a depressing Christmas movie.
I don't even think of it as a Christmas movie. I think it's just a movie that they showed at Christmas because the rights were free. And then it sort of like got grafted.
It is all about Christmas
time.
And there's like
the
whole idea about gifts.
It's all about
and...
Christmas time. The end of the movie happens at Christmas time, but it's about the life of George Bailey. It's like undeniably,
you're
like,
not counting it because you heard it here, folks. Devin does not consider It's a Wonderful Life a Christmas movie, so it doesn't get included in this conversation.
I mean, look, I love It's a Wonderful Life. It is a film that I really enjoy. I have a doctored poster of It's a Wonderful Life. That's me as George Bailey holding up Mary. It's lovely, and I crack it out every December. But I just as I've thought more about the movie. I think of it, it became a Christmas movie because it was on all the time. Really like the Die Hard debate of like, is Die Hard a Christmas movie just because it takes place at Christmas? I've applied that same sort of Bechdel test.
It's a Christmas movie because it's about a man trying to get back to his
family
for
Christmas.
I
know that. But like once people started asking that question about Die Hard, a movie that like very obviously was a Christmas movie to me, I started applying the same critical thought that I applied to Die Hard to prove that it was a Christmas movie to other movies, and the results will shock you. More at 11. It's just, that's the thing. But I don't know, like Christmas was, there was representation for the depression of Christmas, and I feel like it went away. And this reminded me just of how cynical we were about Christmas, specifically in the 90s. I mean, it makes sense, too. We had that depression that was going on in 1992, and now, like, basically our generation said, hold our fucking beer when it comes to, like economic depressions. But so I don't know. It's just, that was the reminder to me, and I don't know if this movie... Made as it was, right? The cast obviously couldn't be the same because Madeline Kahn, you know, rest in peace, 1999. But it, I don't know. I don't know that this movie ever gets made outside of this beautiful window that it has of the cynicism in the 1990s. And that's just the thought that I had when you said maybe it's too early. I think it's at the perfect time. I think it shouldn't have come out in 1994. Right? Like, that's the thing. Like, we oversaturated the market with I'm depressed at Christmas movies. And that's the unfortunate thing related to this one.
Yeah, I think, you know, the other side of that is that it is also not that depressing. Like, as much as it is about depression and about suicide and about all this other stuff that's going on, all of that is just fodder for them to, like, make fun of those things. And I'm not trying to say, like... This is when we now have to talk about this. Like, this movie, the other is insensitive, right? Like comedies, right? Like it is insensitive to certain subject matter. So like there is also that too, right? Is it doesn't quite fit in with the likes of depressing Christmas movies. Because at the end of this movie, you don't feel like these people have learned to not be depressed. Rather, they have just learned that everybody's depressed, so fuck it. Stop trying to make people better.
And on that, I think you've led into a beautiful segue for the synopsis. Because if we don't do it now, we're just going to cannibalize too much of what we have for the latter end of this episode. Are you ready for this? Y'all ready for this? Da-na-na. The place, Venice Beach, California. The date, December 24th, 1994. The plot, 9 people's lives will become inextricably linked in a series of events that proves that love actually is all around us. Let's meet them, shall we? First, we'll start with Philip, owner and proprietor of Lifesavers. No, not the candy. The call-in helpline. Despite his $5,000 annual salary, he is happy because his job is helping people. Just remember, he's better on the phone than in person. Next is Miss Blanche Munchnick, a widow who is exceptionally good at her job, helping talk people down from the ledge, and is only trying to make it to her dead husband's sister's house to celebrate Christmas, but facing increasing difficulties. Our third player is Catherine, with a C, a mousy girl that lives at home with her mother in addition to rounding out the staff at Lifesavers. She nurses a wicked crush on Philip and wishes that one day she will find someone to care about that cares about her as well. Gracie is Catherine's friend. She runs a fashion boutique off the boardwalk, is pregnant, and ready to burst. Today, she's angry with her boyfriend for taking the Santa suit she could have easily sold to buy a car seat for their incoming child. Gracie's boyfriend is Felix, a wall artist without a wall. He got out of prison 7 months ago and is doing what he can to salvage his failing relationship with Gracie and provide for their incoming baby. Bringing us to Chris, also with a C, a transgendered woman who, despite being surrounded by family this holiday, feels alone because of their hatred of her. She initially contacted Lifesavers to have someone to talk to, but was able to get Philip to break the first rule of Lifesavers and disclose their address, prompting Chris to come down to be helped by them in person. In the number 7 spot, we have Dr. Marshall Kinsey, a veterinarian more than willing to apply his skills in service of the human animal. Batting 8th is Mr. LaBelle, a dog lover who lives in the same building where Lifesavers is located. Honestly, he only makes the list because he's in the mural. Robert Klein portrays him, and he got third billing. Rounding out the cast is the reason we're all here, Louie, played by Adam Sandler. This now unemployed t-shirt writer with a schoolboy crush on Catherine also plays the ukulele to accentuate his hands, which he believes are his best feature. Now that you know the players, time to discuss the game. Through eviction notices, suicides, stuck elevators, overdoses, ballroom dancing, broken windshields, manslaughters, and trimming ye old tannenbaum, they'll learn that in every pothole there is hope, and despite Christmas being the time when we examine our choices, both good and bad, under a magnifying glass, the miracle of happiness is attainable, assuming we can find and stand by people we tolerate, nay, love.
Okay. I didn't even know if you had a
pause. No, that's this is an ensemble piece, and more than like summarizing what happens in the movie, it felt good to just like relate who those people are. In some terms,
I mean the,
like
the movie, the movie is just a collection of bits of using like those characters to interact with one another to see what happens. You know, let's see what happens when we get the transgender character in with the young romantic and see what comedy can ensue. You know, like that's kind of the whole like math, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the best that I could do. I mean, I felt this is so strange, like. I understand why people said, you guys got to do Mixed Nuts. Please do Mixed Nuts. How have you not done Mixed Nuts yet? I get it. Especially when you think of all of the scenes in this film that Adam Sandler, like, absolutely is 1,000% Adam Sandler during. Like, he's not even, like, phoning it in a little bit, despite the fact that he has kind of a minor role in everything.
You can tell that he's taking it extremely seriously. He's choosing and doing, he's making some choices and doing some things on screen that are not just Sandler just walking around on the street, right? Like he's definitely putting in effort. The problem comes is that when he's putting in a better or worse effort, but different type of effort than a scene partner might be, like say Liev Schreiber, right, playing Chris. I think that both of these guys are phenomenal actors when given the right space and material. I don't know if they both occupy that same space. I don't know. Maybe they could prove me wrong someday in some future film together, but like it, not what I saw in this movie, right? Like the problem is that you need those moments there. You need there to be chemistry between them in those scenes. Like it needs to almost be heartwarming seeing the two of them getting together in those scenes. And that's not what you feel, right? It feels cold, and it feels like the focus is more supposed to be on watch Adam Sandler play this unsuspecting guy hitting on someone that he doesn't understand their place on the scale, right? Like what is the bit? It's one of those moments where you want to take like Nora Ephron and just be like, what's the joke here, Nora? Please explain it to me.
Have you ever heard of the Kinks? Okay. Would you like a cherry
Oh,
cola?
oh, yeah,
Okay.
he's just like, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of his weird responses to it, yeah.
Yeah, it's but he is, and also, like, shout out to Liev Schreiber. This is his first film role. His
Yeah,
first role.
and only preceded by not being his first film role, period, because the only other thing he'd done up to this point premiered the day before on TV.
Yeah, like it's insane. Which also, when you consider, here's a question for you. We have quizzes over on the other show, but I have a quick quiz for you here. Which film do you think shot first? Mixnuts or Airheads? Not release date, but which film do you think was made first?
Man, if you told me they were shot on the same lot on the same day, I'd believe you. But I guess Mixed Nuts.
No. I would have bet tens of thousands of dollars on the fact that Mixnuts had to have been made before Airheads.
Right.
Airheads was shot between June 21st, 1993 and September 4th, 1993. Mixed Nuts was February 14th, 1994 to May 6th, 1994.
So a few months later, huh,
Yeah,
man.
I would have never thought that because what Adam has on display in something like Airheads, as opposed to this, it feels like it's the first time that he's ever been on a film set. Some of these scenes. Like,
Yeah.
it's like, let's take the SNL kid, let's put him in a movie. He's got this big following from MTV. It brings in the youth viewer. And also, like, by all accounts, he knows how to act and he knows he has good comedic chops. So let's put him into this situation. Like, the scene where he comes in with the tree when Mrs. Mushnick is still stuck in the elevator, like, it feels like he's just goofing around. And that's cool that he's able to do that in, like, the face of working with people like Nora Ephron, who is huge right now in Hollywood because of Sleepless in Seattle. And in a few scenes, he's going to be interacting with Steve Martin and Madeline Kahn and all of these people. I mean, Juliette Lewis as Gracie was in Natural Born Killers the same year.
Yeah,
Like, what the hell? To sort of think that, like, Airheads was shot a full, like, year earlier. Like, in June of 93, they start shooting that film. And then you see Adam Sandler in this role that is just like, he almost feels like just a background actor that gets elevated in the third act. Like,
I mean,
it's
and it is, I mean, I think that's to his credit, right?
Yeah,
Like, I
definitely.
think
Yeah.
that the character itself does that, and he doesn't end up walking on and
And
becoming like a
stealing the
huge
show. Yeah.
scene-shewer, right? Yeah, this movie just kind of just goes all sorts of places, because like we talked about Madeline Kahn, and you mentioned earlier that you had something to say about Rita, what's her name?
Rita
Rita Wilson,
Wilson. Yeah.
right? Like the roles that they have in this movie and where they go in those roles are off the wall. And I mean, with Rita Wilson playing, I mean, I don't know what you have to say about it, but she is definitely the female lead of this movie, right? Like almost the second
Oh
lead
yeah,
of
no,
this
what I had to
movie.
say is the fact that she's the female lead of this movie, and
Yeah.
she's the last build. She's the last single build actor.
But like her having some ups and downs as a character is kind of to be expected, because she kind of has to match what's going on a lot with Steve
With
Martin's
Steve
Phil,
Martin's
right?
film. Yeah, and it makes sense. It's just, I couldn't believe
Put
that.
Madeline Kahn's character and like the weird, I mean, there is a clear moment in this movie where she just takes a left turn and I don't know where it comes from.
She loses her freaking mind, Seijin.
She loses her
She loses her
mind.
freaking
Her
mind.
car gets attacked by a fruitcake, and she decides at that moment that after being this, rather prideful, like old biddy that is, as far as she's concerned, extremely good at her job of helping people, and everyone else in the world is losing their minds. Her car gets attacked, and she just freaks out, steps out of the car, grabs the, as far as I could tell, closest man she can find. I don't think there's anything specific about the man she does find, but the closest man she could find, and just jumps his bones.
I mean, it's clearly hate fucking. Like, they clearly had that hatred relationship where it's like thin line between love and hate.
Once it's him, it becomes that. I don't think it would have met. It could have been a stranger and she would have done it, and then it might not have become hate fucking.
On some level, I'm surprised she didn't fuck Louie when her car, when she was waiting for the AAA to come, because her car wouldn't start. Where they get that beautiful
character choice.
Madeline Kahn to me, I mean, she's a treasure. Madeline Kahn is always going to be a treasure in my eyes. When she's stuck in the elevator with all of the noise making paraphernalia and still nobody hears her, it's such beautiful irony. And she's given her full Madeline Kahn in that moment. Like the rapping with the little drum machine. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. But like, you know, like Rita Wilson, everything that she does is fine. It's just, I then couldn't believe that she gets billing after Adam Sandler and Liev Schreiber. Because it's not like she's known.
It wasn't an introducing.
She's just, it's Liev Schreiber, Rita Wilson. And then the one after that is Parker Posey and Jon Stewart.
Who show up for the two scenes, I think, in the whole thing.
They have three scenes throughout the entire thing. And it's just like, well, they definitely should be billed below her, but I don't know why she is billed so late. If it were an and, it would make sense. It just, you're not hiding the fact that she's there. There is an actor whose identity is straight hidden from the billing. And I think with good reason. But it's just so weird. I don't know. But again, it's also difficult because, like, we're here to judge whether or not this fits into Adam Sandler's cinematic universe, and there's just so little, like, there's so little evidence for us to forensically analyze to try to push it in. You know?
For sure. Yeah. But we could talk about that. There's a reason that we have a format to help us talk
exactly.
about that.
Exactly. That was going to be my segue into everybody's favorite part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue. Do you have your sixpence in your shoe, Sejan?
No, I'm not the new groom. So.
Oh, okay, good. Well, it's actually the bride who would put it in her shoe. I don't know. I remember giving you that sixpence, and I don't even think I know where mine is right now. Also, just because it's a Christmas episode, Christmas is how many days away? This is going to drop on the 9th, so 14 days away. It's 14 days till Christmas. Following the new old borrowed blue for Christmas gifts or gifts in general, it works. So if you're not sure what to buy somebody, think in those terms. But what we do here at New Old Borrowed Blue on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we point out something that would be new to the universe if this were to be included and, you know, assimilated into it, something old that already exists in the universe, something borrowed from outside the universe, from the grander Hollywood cinematic machine, and then something blue, the definition of which is always under constant debate. So starting with something new, Sejan, why don't you go first? Because I may have stolen yours.
No, we've already talked about it a lot, but this is kind of the first movie where we see Adam Sandler really taking a step back in a lot of regards. And now, like, this is an easy one, right? Because it is so early in his film career he's not the powerhouse, right? But as we mentioned, like, Airheads filmed before this, like, you can see other movies that he is in around this time, and he clearly has a lot more presence and clearly has these moments that are very much him, right? This movie, while I feel like he definitely got to make a lot of his own choices for the character, at no point does it feel like he ever walked in and was like, I think that the script should do this, or like, I was wondering if we could do that. It feels very much like he takes a backseat.
Yeah.
And I don't know if after this movie, if we ever get to see it again, right? Because once he does Billy Madison, he's in the driver's seat for his films for the rest of his career, kind of.
Right. It'll be interesting going forward looking at films, seeing if there's anything where he is just kind of a soldier. I mean,
there are a couple of them that come to mind, but we haven't watched yet for the show. Things like the Meyerowitz stories, right? Like, is another one where he's not like a main leader, or even something like Week of, the one he does with Chris Rock, right? Which is about the two families coming together for the wedding.
Right. My initial thought would be something like Men, Women, and Children, where it's another big ensemble piece.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's clearly got the ability, because the other one that jumps to mind is Uncut Gems. Like, so much of that is, I am just here in an acting role. This is
sure,
your guy's
but there is
story.
definitely a lot of things that he's bringing to the table in that regard, where I feel like there was a lot more like, Mr. Sandler, we were thinking this, and him saying, yeah, I think we can do that. That courtesy does not get extended to him on this set. You know what I mean?
I find that, I mean, I don't doubt that, but when you look at things like,
I mean, this,
there's the, so the, much improv
I mean, Uncut
in this
Gems,
movie, too.
Right.
No, I mean, Uncut Gems, I know, like, but that was him building the character. They very much knew what the story was going to be and all of that. It's not something like where he gets into Billy Madison and he's saying to the director, well, can we do this? Can we take the story in this direction? Can we do that? Like he, and then.
Sure. If it were a sliding scale, like his own, like produced films would definitely be at the far end of it. But I think this would probably be the other end, the low end.
Oh, this possibly some of the other ones before it. I mean, the really interesting thing I found, because I went back all the way to Going Overboard, his very first film, because I wanted to see if maybe some of the, like, he had worked with someone in that film and they came forward to be in Mixed Nuts. Like, if they just, like, happenstance or anything like that. And the weirdest bit of trivia for Going Overboard, and I swear it's all going to connect here, is that he considers Billy Madison his first film, which is a really interesting thing to think of. And I wonder if he just means of these roles, films where he's the starring role, or if he just also writes off his appearances in Coneheads, Airheads, and Mixed Nuts. If he looks at them as more training than...
Right. I mean, if he's just walking on set, being handed a script, saying his lines in front of a camera and walking away, he feels like he's not really like part of the movie making experience, because like this is getting into some really like artsy fartsy, like full hearts bullshit. But like at the end of the day, we used to teach in theater when I was teaching. I'm sure they still teach it that way. But when I was teaching, the way that we taught it is like it's a collaborative art, right? Like film and theater, like the reason that you do these types of art as opposed to sculpture work or like, you know, like is because you want to be working with other people. You want there to be a connection that is made. And I can, and that being said, there is tons of stuff out there, both theatrically and film, where that kind of work doesn't happen for every single person in, you know, in the formula. Some people just show up and just go to work and just do the like work things and then go home, but they're not part of that. And I think that's probably where that comes from, is he probably feels like Billy Madison was the first time where he was kind of part of the ensemble and part of the creative process in a way that he just probably wasn't on any of these movies before that.
Yeah. And it speaks to your thing of like, I don't think he got to make his own choices, which does feel weird because Louis very much feels like a character that he built. And like,
I feel like Nora Ephron said to him, oh, you know that thing you do? Can you do that? And he was just like, grumble, grumble, fine. It was what a lot of it feels like. It feels like it is Adam Sandler stuff, but it feels like it's stuff that somebody else saw him do and asked him to do it again.
Which, God, then that makes Billy Madison make all sorts of other decisions as to why he would approach it the way that he approached it. Wow, this could be the one, right? This could be the origin story in a lot of ways.
I think it's a huge origin story for him in a lot of ways, because he's also on a Nora Ephron-led film after she's done Sleepless in Seattle with Steve Martin in the lead, and this movie bombs so hard. That's got to teach you, like, from moment one, like, hey, even the greats can face this kind of shit, right? And it's why after Billy Madison also doesn't do well critically, but does well enough financially and all that, like he realizes, I'm just not going to read like criticism anymore. Like he's openly talked about how after Billy Madison, he stopped reading criticism in general because he realized it didn't do anything for him. And I mean, like that has to start when you're on a movie like this, right? Where you're in what you probably are assuming when that script is in your hands and you're being told what's going on with that project, you have to feel like, this is an opportunity, right? And then when that opportunity falls a little flat, you learn real quick to grow some thick skin.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, you definitely took my new with the bit Sandler of it all. So what I will take is the adaptation of of French farce, right? It's the first time that he's seeing it. I think it's probably why he's more open to doing something like Just Go With It. Like,
yeah, because that's new to him, but it's not new to us, because then we see something with like Just Go With It later on, right?
Yeah. So I'm subverting exactly what this is about, but I think this is what brings that to his mind in terms of, you don't just have to remake English films. You can borrow from the entire pantheon of cinema history.
Well, especially because, as we know from other projects, how much he loves movies, right?
Yeah.
So the idea of working on a movie that is this remake of this popular French film and all of this, I'm sure that there is some element of that that is also exciting to him. Whether or not he's like deep into French farce cinema or any of that is probably nonsense. But the idea being that there is that kind of history to it has to sound even at least a little cool, right? If you're somebody that is into movies.
Well, and I think it's why, you know, when something like Just Go With It comes to you and it's like, oh, it's his remake of this French farce. And he's like, oh, I'll listen to that. I was in Mixed Nuts. That was that thing. Like, it's, I think is what opens his eyes to it not being something to write off, is actually being involved with one, right?
Yeah.
I also think that this is why he's okay going as dark as he sometimes goes with his comedy. Because, like, you know, if the people don't like it, you can always just do something else. and then the next one. He learns a lot on this film. I think that, like, a lot of the tenets of what makes Adam Sandler the creative force that he is probably inspired by his work on Mixed Nuts. Jeez. Like, yep. Sorry. I'm sorry. It's just thinking about it. Like, Origins of Sandler, Mixed Nuts edition.
Shall we move into old?
Let us move into old. And I'm going to go first. And I'm going to say Jon Stewart. Because I, first of all, forgot that Jon Stewart was in Big Daddy. Like, all the way back there. And then I see Jon Stewart's name in the things and I'm like, hot fucking damn. They had worked together in a film before. And then I watched the movie and, of course, they have exactly one scene with one another. And at that point, he is just playing the ukulele at that moment. He is not even like really involved in all of the action that's going on forward.
Well, and then Stewart is gone after that, right? Like, they hit them with that bike and then they just run off, or with that tree, and then they just run off, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. They don't stick around. They're not there for the Merry thing. Merry Christmas from Doug and Carol Ferguson. Like, it's really interesting to see it, and it really made me happy that we kind of bookended season 4 for the fans with Jon Stewart appearing in these films with Adam Sandler.
So love it. Love
I'm going to go with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I had a point to the fact that I kind of already talked about this, but like, funny voice, Billy is back. Like, this is Sandler doing classic early 90s Sandler comedy. It is not the same kind of comedy he does now, but they are in the same family. But like, basically, if he puts on a funny voice, he's a completely different person. And like, that's like not a hard rule in these movies, because he's been plenty of different people without funny voices. But you can almost guarantee that he can like fall into a character, improvise for the next 3 days if you want him to, if he can just find like a funny voice to give that character.
Yeah.
And that is exactly why I think he's cast in this role. And I think that Nora Ephron uses him like a tool in that regard. And I think that can be part of why he maybe doesn't feel like this was like an Adam Sandler experience for people.
Which is crazy, because all of that stuff is so Adam Sandler, that's the reason why it's so fondly remembered. All these people who watch this for the first time, be it 2020, 2021, like 2020, because what else are we going to watch now? And then, oh, now that you're still looking for stuff, let me recommend Mixed Nuts to you. It's, I think the reason why everybody was clamoring, like, why wouldn't you do this movie, is because, like, it's such a distilled out Adam Sandler performance. But also, like, imagine having something like that in this movie full of all this comedic content and actors and just talent, and then being like, oh, is that what I'm going to be remembered for? Because the other thing is that, as good as Steve Martin is, it is his shtick distilled down to the frickin' syrup. It is Rob Reiner's shtick distilled down to the syrup. Madeline Kahn is doing. She's Mrs. Peacock. She is every time she's ever sang on camera. Like, they're all boiled down to what they're best known for.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, they're playing character archetypes, and in that, they kind of become their own archetypes of themselves as actors. It's, like, really wild to watch.
And then, but, like, to see that frozen in amber, because obviously Jurassic Park is in your mind, right? And to think if they clone Adam Sandler frigging 65 million years from now for, you know, Sandlastic Park, what do I want people, why do people want to come see the Adam Sandler dinosaurs? Is it because of what I did in Mixnuts, or do I maybe want to continue to grow and change in the way that I approach comedy and acting and creativity?
Well, and how much, like, he wants to put himself into that at no, like, at no time does he feel shame. he is shameless in some of the choices that he makes. But I mean, like, all power to him. And I it's wild. It's wild what working on what you think might be a surefire hit and then it flops can really do to your psyche.
Yes, sir. Whew. All right. I'll let you start with Borrowed, because if you and I have the same Borrowed, Sajan, I'm taking you to Las Vegas tonight.
So, as far as, like, the Borrowed stuff goes, like, very often the reason that this category, that this section even exists, is that when Sandler's kind of leading the charge, we can talk about his choices, right? And the thing is, as we've talked about, he didn't get to make many of his own choices on this one. So Borrowed got a little tricky for me, because everything I was looking at, I was like, but this isn't Sandler choosing this, right? For this moment, it's coming from something that Nora Ephron loves or something that Steve Martin loves or blah, 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 right? So focusing specifically on him, he is clearly into the young romantic character that is super popular in French farces, right? Like when I think of this character, like, one of the other big ones that I always think of in this regard, as far as, like, French, like, scripts go, is Christian from Cyrano de Bergerac, right? Where he's buff, he's dumb, he's talented, he can't be stopped. Women love him. Men want to be him. Like, that type of, that type of role, that's exactly who Louis is in this movie, right? Is Phil is jealous of him. Phil is jealous of the kind of, like, weird, like, spell that he's able to put over Catherine almost instantly with this song that he sings on an instrument that he plays live in front of everybody. You know, meanwhile, Phil's losing his business. His life is falling apart. Then you add to that the moments between him and Chris, right? And he just... as I said, those moments, really what they want to be is extremely heartwarming, and they feel like they almost get there because of kind of the charm that's on display with this young character, this young lover, right? And he borrows, like, from that archetype throughout movie history, like, beautifully. Like, he is sweet, he is focused on whoever he's speaking to. He instantly jumps to the aid of a young lady when Chris is in trouble, right? Like, he feels the need to run to them, despite, like, everybody there seeing the, like, the joke of it being this transgendered character. Like he, I couldn't tell you whether or not he understands the full story with Chris. And I don't think that it really matters in the long run, but, like, it's an interesting thing to consider, considering everybody else's reactions to Chris in this movie. And, like, Sandler and Louis are just so sweet to them and so kind. And, like, it almost feels like the joke must just be that he's naive, right? Except that's never clarified.
No, it's you mentioned that Gracie and Felix are the young lovers, and very clearly they are in the archetype of a French farce. But the love story that I'm more interested in is Chris and Louis. Like, it works.
If it's easier to think about, like if they're Romeo and Juliet, he's clearly what's the cousin there? Mercutio, is he the one, Romeo's cousin, or is Mercutio the one that gets killed?
Mercutio is the one who gets killed. Tybalt is Juliet's cousin.
No. Mercutio is the one that I'm thinking of then.
Okay, yeah.
Because he's just like this. The one that has the Queen Mav speech, right? Like,
yep.
Where he loves to love, right? Like, he's this romantic, handsome character that everybody just instantly is just, like, swooning over, because he just has this charm about him, right? And Sandler plays it perfectly.
Yeah, and it almost makes me wish that there was a little bit more with it, because it just coming in at the end... Like, not like I wish that in some way we got to see Munchnik charmed by him in that moment where he's like, oh, I was in the automobile club, but they found that I don't have a car. So like, like, and it's just clearly
that
Madeline
joke.
Kahn is
playing. I love
it's
that
so
joke.
Good. And Madeline Kahn is just playing, like, at that point she's annoyed. So she doesn't get to have that like moment where she is. And even when she's stuck in the elevator, she's annoyed. So we don't get to see it. It would be nice if we could see that, like, his positivity sort of rubs off on everybody. And then at the end of it, like, you can argue that Christine falls for the song, but she's also in that moment trying to make Philip jealous. Like, the reason why she invites Louis upstairs is because Munchnik has said that there's some strumpet upstairs with Philip. Like,
you're talking
about
Catherine in that moment?
Yeah, Catherine in that moment where she says, I'd love to hear it, and invites Louis upstairs. It's because she's like, well, if he's got someone up there, I'm going to make him jealous with Louis.
So, yes, definitely that's the read on that scene for me as well. But I get the impression that after he starts singing the song, she does kind of legitimately swoon over him. She can't take her eyes off of him. And it's what Phil reacts to and why he ends up giving him all this shit at the table.
I understand. It's just that's... I don't know. But then we get to when Louis is with Chris, and it's so beautiful to me because it's played so earnestly. And honestly, it's Venice Beach in the 90s. We don't know much about Louis. We know that he writes t-shirt phrases. Louis could be pansexual. He could just want to understand the person inside. He could be 100% aware of Chris's situation. And you know what? I'm with somebody who wants to be with me tonight on Christmas Eve. And that's enough for me, right?
Like I said, he's a character that loves love. Yeah. So the idea that even if it were revealed that he knew everything that was going on with Chris, I still would buy all of this that he's doing. It would almost make more sense if he knew what was actually going on, because he just loves being helpful. Like, and I think that that's also an important role in this story about all these cynical people, cynical and depressed, like sad, dark things that are going on. Having this one character that is just this like overly optimistic, bright, shining light, right, is funny.
Yeah, it's true. Especially with all these people who are supposed to help people, and then Louis can do it almost effortlessly.
And this is why people remember the Adam Sandler parts of this movie, right? And why people are like, you need to watch this. I think it's because they don't remember what happens in the rest of this movie.
They don't remember the other stuff. They remember this beautiful turn that Adam Sandler has in the third act of this film. Honestly, for me, my read of it, he's completely aware of what's going on with Chris. And you know what? He's down. He's okay with it. And that's what I did. Like, that is the most heartwarming story to me, is that they find each other on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, like, applying the context of it's 1994 and the ways in which everybody was reacting to this sort of stuff then, I find it hard to believe that that's the intention of that scene. But maybe this is to the Efron's, like, credit, both of them. I don't know who wrote the scenes and who didn't on these ones, but, like, that it is never... It doesn't deny that as a possible truth, which is, I think, kind of important, is that, like, it is kind of up to you as the reader to kind of insert your current politics. And, like, not everything can be easily balanced in that way, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I've also been just kind of trumping and drumping and stretching, because now I'm embarrassed in my bar route. Because you did the assignment, and I was just like, Dirty Dancing is Dirty Dancing. The whole dance sequence, the way that Chris approaches it, is so Jennifer Grey in scenes of Dirty Dancing. The one that, like, specifically where I wrote in my book, borrowed Dirty Dancing, and was like, and we're done, is when she's standing in the doorway arch, and she puts her hand over her head. That way that baby does it, like, right before she, like, does the strut over to Swayze. And it's just, like, all I could think of was Dirty Dancing in that moment. I mean, that whole dance sequence is incredible. And, I mean, clearly I'm going to have some thoughts on it, I think, once we get to your blue, unless I've completely misread everything that you're thinking on it. But that sequence is gorgeous. As much as I love the Louis stuff, that whole dance sequence, there are some things that keep it from being phenomenal, but there is so much of it that, like, that's what I wanted. When I told my parents to watch it, I'm like, this is one of the things I want to make sure you guys get to experience.
Yeah, there's definitely some stuff to be said about that, but I don't want to trample over your blue if you want to go first.
Oh, my blue. Honestly, this was a hard one to find blue in, is what I'm going to say. And I ended up settling on, and you know, you can get mad at me if you want to, people, Mrs. Mushnick's periwinkle coat before she goes and has, before she chooses to go and have beach sex. I don't want to know the type of person who, like, willingly is like, let's go have sex on the beach. The sand, Seijin? The sand? Oh, it haunts my dreams, all the sand.
They put showers by that beach for a reason.
That's true. But yeah, but it's like, it's this beautiful shade of periwinkle, her coat. And that was the blue that I went with. Because so often, so often I'm just looking for, like, my blue duck. And there was no blue duck. And I wanted, all I wanted to write was that Louis's little gondolier outfit was a navy jacket, but it's very clearly black.
No, it's definitely black.
It's not, and don't think that I bought the Pantone.
Why is he in that outfit, by the way?
Oh, he's in that outfit?
I know he says something at some point to, what's Julia Dreyfus'
Juliette Lewis's name? Oh, what is her name? Juliette Lewis?
Julia Lewis. Juliette Lewis. What is
Gracie.
Yeah, hold on, I got the.
He says it to Gracie.
He says to Gracie, like, I want to have an outfit too. And she's like, I'll get to you. And then cut to, that's the outfit he ends up in at the end of the night.
Yeah, it's like, that's the first time I watched it, I'm like, why the fuck is he dressed like a gondolier right now? And
yeah,
then watch it the second time, I'm like, oh, because he wants to match too. Like, Gracie is playing matchmaker, trying to get Catherine and Philip together. That is very clearly the role. So she gives them the two matching iconic mixed nut outfits. And then when
iconic.
Well, it's what Steve Martin is wearing on the cover.
Right,
that
as iconic
that
as
he
it
looked
could be
at,
in this
like,
movie.
And I was very happy to see that, like, oh, they match. Also, I thought Mixed Nuts was a very different movie based purely on that. Like, I thought it was like a Christmas party of people who knew each other and wacky stuff ensued. The fact that they're all basically strangers, zang. Mm-hmm. But then he's like, I want to match too. And the way that he matches them, it's like almost brilliant in the fact that, and you play the gondolier who drives the boat on their beautiful night together in the canals of Venice. You match. Yeah. You just don't match the way you want to match. Yeah. But it's very clearly black.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to think of how to pivot from that. There's a lot in this movie that, like, you can point to. As I said earlier, like, by its very nature of being a dark comedy, it's already going to be, like, ruffling feathers. That's how dark comedies work, right? Like, gallows humor and all that. And so, like, I
didn't think that movie, The Gallows, was funny at all, Seijin. I'm sorry.
I mean,
I know you didn't need that right now.
It wasn't scary or good either, but
actually, I thought that movie was hilarious. I can't believe I still haven't watched the sequel. Oh, I laughed out loud during The Gallows.
Is that the one with the high school that becomes
it?
Never mind.
It's a high school play, and it's like haunted because someone died. Oh, it's a weird movie. It's not Adam Sandler in any way.
Oh, man, there's just, I mean, the reason that I'm hesitating is because there's so much that we could talk about, so much stuff that should be called out. I mean, like,
well,
as,
call it out. That's
as
what
beautiful
for.
As those, as beautiful as those moments with Chris are, and it's not enough. There's too much damage done to that character for it to be justifiable. Like, it's such a shame because such an early role and such an opportunity. I mean, like, a person reaching out for help. And let me be very clear. I think Chris as a character doesn't do anything wrong in this movie. They are nothing but sincere and sweet and all of that, but the ways that everybody else reacts to them is just unforgivable. Like, the jokes that are made, and it's, at first it feels like, oh, is this going to be everybody learning to not behave this way? No, nobody changes by the end of this movie in the ways that they treat Chris. So, like, that, but that is what it is. Like, that is something that we have talked about so far. That being said, there are other things to talk about. We've kind of offhandedly mentioned that they work at a suicide hotline, but like we straight up like see that entire scene with Stephen Wright where like the guy calls in for help, and because it's a bad connection, like we hear the gunshot, and then it's just, oh my God, that like
Well, if they're really
Seth
in stress,
MacFarlane
they'll call
style
back.
joke. Yeah. Oh my God. Or they just wait. I hated myself, but I promise you, from the moment that bit started till like minutes later, I was like tears rolling, laughing at that joke, and I there it is.
That's suicide played for laughs.
Yeah, that's just what happens in like, and that's in the first act of this movie. By the end of this movie, another person, another dead body ends up in this thing. Why are we hiding this? They end up killing the landlord in order to save the building,
Well,
right?
yeah, I don't know
And
why we're hiding it is because they hide the identity of the landlord. He does not get any sort of billing, and it's Gary Shandling when
yeah.
Gary Shandling is one of the hottest fucking commodities in Hollywood.
I literally have a note here, though, that is my very kind of last note. Why am I okay with shooting Gary Shandling? There's that moment where that where so through a series of wacky farcical events, right? Juliette Lewis ends up with Gracie ends up with a loaded revolver that has three or four shots left, and I think it's three
It
by that
is
time
three,
by that
yeah.
point. And she is pregnant, so of course she's got pregnancy brain. I think that's supposed to be the bit for her for this whole movie, but she decides that the best way to empty the gun is to just fire it off in random directions, sending two through the front door of the apartment. At which point, once kind of all of the like ruckus of her shooting a live weapon in the house goes down, in the apartment goes down, we suddenly realize, and it's a beautiful sound cue, that the front door that the door has been buzzing, and you don't quite know how long it's been buzzing, but you do know that she just shot through that door. And like from the moment that that whole like bit starts, I started getting like this like tight thing in my stomach because I didn't I you know I can watch a movie 1,000 times and not tell you how it ends. Like I forget details all the time. I forgot entirely what was going on. So like when that started happening, I was like, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no. And then the door opened and revealed who it was, Gary Shandling, with two bullet holes in him, and he just falls over dead. I
Yeah.
laughed.
It's one of those situations where the only reason that I couldn't laugh, right? And maybe that's the other reason why I think this film could not have been made and received after 1994 is like improper gun use
Yeah.
is it's like the second she's like, I need to empty it, and I'm like, oh, she's just gonna take the bullets out. Oh no, she's just shooting wildly. Like that part of my brain that has lived through just so many like incidents with live firearms
She's
is.
in an apartment in California. I mean, like, come on. Like, riots are all over the state in the early 90s, and the idea of just like guns being shot off everywhere is just it's
It's
crazy
like
that
that.
that is what they choose to do at that moment.
It's just like it made my stomach sick, and I'm like, this is not something I can laugh about. And then they kill Gary Shandling, and I'm like, oh, Gary Shandling's dead. I guess like that means the building won't sell. And then the beautiful thing is Steve Martin, like, no, I'm in the sale, still gonna go through. We're not saved because he's dead. This does not solve our problems. And I'm just like, so Gary Shandling's just dead? And then, you know, and then I think and I'm like, Hail Hydra. And I'm like, oh, we avoided it. We avoided it retroactively by revealing that he was a member of Hydra. Everything's gonna be okay and I can deal with it. And it was also one of those situations where there's a huge Chekhov's gun in this movie with the Seaside Strangler.
It's so well hidden,
I
though.
know.
Like, it's not a true Chekhov's gun because, in order to be a true Chekhov's gun, it
Yeah.
has to be obvious. And it's not. It's not obvious. But it is such an amazing callback. I think it is a beautiful twist because I literally, this movie, today, again, could not remember how it ended. I literally said out loud the words, "You're going to have to do a lot of work to justify this one." And then they like instantly did, because when they like revealed what was like in the bag and that he is the Seaside Strangler, was the Seaside Strangler, I'm just like, touche. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it totally, I was sickened by
it. I thought
it
was going to be like a KKK hood or something. Like, oh, you killed a racist.
And it is a situation death, of, like, and right. You get the reward because you killed him. And then I'm like, wow, it was really just Wild West fucking justice in the 90s. Where, like, yeah, you kill the guy. $250,000? That's yours. Like, it made me want to become a bounty hunter or something.
Not anymore, though. Thanks, you know. Obama.
That's not funny. And yet I laugh.
You don't get to laugh and then say that.
No, it's I'm nervous laughing. I'm the kind of guy who laughs at a funeral scene. If you can't understand what I mean.
You understand what it means.
You soon will. Or you probably already do. No, it's so well done. And then all I could think of when they disguise Mr. Tannenbaum as a Christmas tree is that meme of the girl yelling at the guy at the music festival, like, see, they dressed him up like a tree because Tannenbaum is German for tree. It's comedy.
But this all leads to my actual blue, which is the reveal of him being the Seaside Strangler and that acknowledgement that this character that we're all having a good laugh about because of all this shit that's happened to them is, as we have been told, a serial killer and rapist. It's crazy.
Rape played for laughs.
Yeah. So that's my big clue for this movie. Of all of the things that I think really push things into uncomfortable directions, I won't go full Mindy Kaling and call out what will or won't work anymore in comedy, but I will say that's cool. That's a yellow card right there. That would be a rough one for most people.
I think that the gun stuff is also a yellow card just because of how it's affected so much in America.
Yeah.
You know what I am going to do, though? Something happy comes from your blue, and that's I'm going to... Obviously, it's not a full-on new, right? But I was already kind of toying with what that is. I think this might be the movie where Adam Sandler realized that cross-dressing is hilarious. And that's why we see Steve Buscemi's character in Billy Madison. Why we see just so many transgendered moments.
I love this idea that it was only Sandler perpetuating this, and this is where he learned it from Nora Ephron. But like, this was the problem is, Dev, is this was happening everywhere in comedy and all of that.
Gay,
you know, like
it totally was a thing. But I think that like you didn't see it prior to this, and I think him being involved in a film.
Look at what's the Tom Hanks one there, Bosom Buddies. That borders in some problematic ways and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the problem is he learns the lesson. Because also think about a lot of those scenes where it's played for laughs, a transgendered or a transvestite character in later Adam Sandler films.
Think the term transvestite is old school and maybe not used anymore? I'm going to call us both out on that now because I also said it earlier.
Right. Well, no. I mean, I think both of us would agree that Chris is full on a transgendered woman, right? I don't think in any way it's not played in any other way other than the fact that Chris was assigned male
Chris identifies
at birth
as a woman,
and
yeah.
is now identifying as a woman. I want to make sure of that. But I'm saying in those moments where it is played in other Adam Sandler films, where it might just be somebody who cross-dresses, which is sort of where transvestite comes from. I know it's an outdated term, but that's how I was meaning it. It's always played so earnestly. And I think that maybe seeing the Chris role played as earnestly as it is in this film is why it is something that we see perpetuated in a lot of the creative choices from Adam Sandler.
I mean, there's definitely something to be said about the idea that you can understand why he almost feels like he's allowed to do this sort of stuff later, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's not excusing it. It's not saying that it's okay, but I think it's another one of those origins of Sandler moments where it's like having George in The Wedding Singer be this type of character. The joke is people's reaction to it. George is not the joke. We're laughing at the ignorance of the people who and how they respond to George. We're not supposed to be laughing at the character of George.
And it's
a very thin line of distinction, but it's
Right. It's
Yeah.
that problem that like gorilla-handed comedians always have when they're handling sensitive subjects. Like is that the drawing that distinct line between like we're representing this character and we want to call out the ways in which the world treats them versus we're treating them that way. Right. It gets very hard to like if you need a deft hand to do that. And I love Sandler, but I would not necessarily call him subtle when it comes to his comedy, you know?
Yeah, I agree. But it's something that, like, when you're talking as much as what you're talking about, Chris, and just the way that the Sandler reacts to that character as
Right.
Louis, I mean, I think one of the reasons why I believe that, like, no, if these two go off and have some sort of relationship, I 100% believe it because of just how it's being portrayed by the actors in that moment. And I think that, like, that earnesty about it is the thing. But also, like, look at that scene. It's wrong, but it's hilarious when Steve Martin goes to sit next to Chris on the couch and then does that big fucking slide as far away as possible. That is hilarious physical
Well,
comedy. But the
right.
joke there is not Chris. The joke is how Steve Martin's Philip is reacting to Chris.
No, but then Nora Ephron does turn around and throw one of those moments in there just 2 seconds later when the lights go out and the lights come back on to reveal that Chris has like slid over and put their arm around
Yeah.
Phil, right?
Yeah.
Like is like she openly just like approaches him in a way that he's made it clear he does not want to be approached, I guess is the best
Yeah.
way to put that.
Yeah.
But like I so then it comes down to that thing, right? That we were just talking about of like when you're trying to call out society and the ways in which it treats a person, you need to portray that on screen, right? So seeing the ways that an individual like Phil treats an individual like Chris and then having them discuss it, like that is good, right? Like that can move the needle forward depending on how that discussion goes. But like that is ways in which you can be progressive, starting from this really problematic standpoint and then moving to a more educated standpoint, right? And the problem is that this movie starts all of that and never quite gets to any final conclusion on that stuff. And I'm not saying that it's this movie's sole responsibility to teach everybody in 1994 how to treat people in this situation where they're questioning themselves and their identity and all that. But if you're going to use this character in this way, if you're going to use a character like Chris, you better damn well be ready to do the work to use that character. And they don't. Like whether that's on, Nora Ephron and her sister as a writing partner, or Nora Ephron as a director, or Liev Schreiber in portraying them and not maybe, maybe saying more about some of the stuff that was happening as that character. And again, I like you don't want to point fingers at individuals and say, this is your fault for doing this, but you all as a collective choosing to do this thing on screen had a responsibility and they did not meet it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Whew.
Yeah.
This got headier than I was expecting, and I'm very happy about that because there's a lot to parse out about this film, and I think the only really unfortunate thing about it is how little Adam Sandler actually factors into a lot of the discussion topics of this particular film. I mean, it's
No,
not.
I think quite the opposite. It's important that he doesn't factor into a lot of this problematic stuff with this movie, which is why he is the one that comes out smelling like roses, and why when you talk about Adam Sandler, people think of this movie and think of it fondly. If you think of Steve Martin, if you talk to people about your Steve Martin podcast and you say, "Hey, we're gonna do mixed nuts for Christmas," they're like, "Don't bury that for the man."
Yeah.
Like
You know what? Christmas with the Coopers is pretty good. The dog's the narrator. Spoilers for Christmas with the
Is that the one
Coopers.
where he adopts the young lady? No, that's a simple twist of fate. Well, do that one instead.
I'm sticking with Christmas with the Coopers. The really crazy thing about this, I think the last thing that I want to discuss before we talk about, the reason why we're actually here, is that Juliette Lewis is really the only one who has a Christmas film under their belt. Like everyone else, this is their
Before
first
doing this.
Christmas film. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Steve Martin goes forward and does a couple more. Adam Sandler goes and does a Hanukkah film, which makes sense. But Christmas is a big part of Eight Crazy Nights. Like a lot of people then go forward after working on this to do Christmas movies. But it's very strange to think that, like, Juliette Lewis portraying Audrey in Christmas Vacation in 1989 is the only one who, like, oh, I've been in a Christmas movie before. I know what I have to do. Dress up like Mary and be 7 months pregnant.
Oh my God. See, so is like that bit, that like that's such bit. A great visual bit where she's dressed like Mary. And like you could see it start to come together. Like the second that she has that thing over her head and she's walking around pregnant, like you're just like, oh no, how far are they gonna go with it? And then the whole way. Oh man.
The one thing I don't like about Juliette Lewis's character is when she fills up that sports bottle with milk and drinks it through a plastic straw. Oh my God. That milk has gotta be warm. I just wanna vomit right now.
The worst part is that she spends half of her time drinking it and half of her time bubbling into it, like just backwashing into it.
I'm drinking iced tea here, Sejan. Jesus. Speaking of which, Jesus.
Yeah, it's not pretty. We've mentioned Felix, but like.
Yeah, we haven't talked a lot about Anthony LaPaglia in this
film.
Anthony
LaPaglia in this movie is Felix.
I love Anthony LaPaglia, and it's...
I think he's just so... I mean, okay. They don't commit to it, and I don't know why, but when he comes back from after taking the pills at the vet, and is, it starts the first couple of lines woofing, I just
oh my God, is he a dog now? Is that what's happened?
What a stupid joke, because he took dog medicine, he's woofing.
And it's for
when the whole reason they're at the vet is because the vet can treat humans because
he can't afford to go to the hospital. Like,
oh my God.
The craziest thing about this movie is that every single building block is there in order to give it a good foundation and a structurally sound film. But at the end of the day, you look at it the wrong way and it crumbles. And it's insane how that happens.
Yeah.
It really is just... shout out to the fact that Victor Garber is the annoyed neighbor. I really dig that moment. Because Victor Garber has that great scene in Sleepless in Seattle when they're talking about the war movies like they were romantic comedies.
Yeah, classic cinema.
So, like, when Stanley Tanenbaum is on the buzzer and he just yells... What are you doing? You're making a lot of noise. It's just like, Victor Garber? That's a nice surprise.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about John Stewart playing one biker. Did we talk about Parker Posey playing the other?
They're rollerbladers, all right?
There's no more 1994
thing than the fact that they are rollerbladers. Doug and Carol Ferguson.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's Parker Posey. And like... God, it's great. It's just fantastic. This little role that they play, basically they're Elaine and they're the neighbors from Christmas Vacation, just in rollerblader form. I also want to talk about, as much as in all of these other movies, New York is a character unto itself, Venice Beach is a character unto itself. And it's really interesting in the grander like universe of Hollywood that Woody Harrelson is in White Men Can't Jump, and then Juliette Lewis is in this film. So it kind of gives this like weird cohesion to Venice Beach and the Venice Beach boardwalk of the two natural born killers.
I will say like a lot of the bits about Venice Beach felt like they were straight up lifted from L.A. Story, Steve Martin's movie from a couple years previously, where he kind of writes a love letter to L.A. And it's very if you've never seen L.A. Story, it is the most, like, straight-faced played satire I've ever seen in my life. Like, I didn't understand that movie the first time I saw it because I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, they're playing this like it's a normal-ass day, but Steve Martin just got instructions from God via a signpost on the side of the highway. Like, why are we not addressing this? Like, and I realized much later it's because it is almost like watching, like, Hot Shots if nobody thought it was a joke. And so a lot of the bits where they build out L.A. in that movie, there's a lot of that kind of doofy humor of like guy on park bench, like dressed up like a candy cane, like you see in this one, like where you're just like, oh, Venice Beach, the sand snowman, the Sandman was pretty damn good.
So good.
Didn't want to call a Sandman outright because then you just think I was talking about Sandman.
Adam Sandler dressed as that, you know, the candy cane. And the great thing is that Venice Beach is so alive. Because then there's that scene later on where they're taking Felix to the vet that the candy cane is walking around trying to get people to take pictures with it. And that the Sandman and the Candyman and the candy cane are both at the like birth of Felix and Gracie's child. Like,
yeah, yeah. I actually was just pointing out with some of the other not so great Christmas movies we've been watching this Christmas season, how weird it is how often like they'll mention like we're in Chicago, but then they'll be walking down the street and there just won't be people around. And like, yeah, it's supposed to be like midnight or something, but like midnight in a city, it's not dead like this, right? And this movie does not have that problem, right? Like, no. So it was very noticeable to me how alive Venice Beach was, because I was distinctly just talking about how bad city scenes often are in Christmas movies.
Yeah. And they do a good job, and I like that. I like that they lean into the setting, especially because as soon as it's Venice, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I love a Christmas movie in a warm climate where, like, there's not going to be snow in this movie. If you came here for snow, get the fuck out. And I love that. And so from the beginning, I'm like, I love that this is taking place in California. There's not going to be snow. That's not going to be how this ends. It's going to have to lean into some of the other lessons of Christmas if that's how they're going to end this. And right. They do. And they absolutely do. The only thing that bothers me about it is that they cut out one of the wise men at the end of the credits when they reshow the mural. They cut out the wise men in blue. And I'm just like, that's a shame. That's why you can't be my blue wise man. All right, so now it's time. It's decision time. Is this in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe?
No, I don't think this movie gives us nearly anything Sandler-ish enough to include it. And in fact, I think Sandler's own words speak volumes when he says that he considers Billy Madison to be the first true film he worked on. Pretty much means that anything before that, we're going to have to find some real good excuses to include them in the formula.
Cool. I love it when we make things more difficult for ourselves by looking up information. It's so much better when we fly by the seat of our pants. Honestly, I could go either way with this one, but I do agree. Based on how Adam approaches it and the fact that Billy Madison, without a doubt, even with how he started this show, is the start of what would be the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, it would be very difficult to put this one in there. At the same time, Louis, very, very, very Adam Sandler. But just because
the character is,
yeah.
Like, it's like the character, I said this at the very beginning, it feels like he just like fell into this movie out of a different movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And like, and that's it. And clearly there's a heaven and a hell, because I don't know if it's God or the devil who answers Rita Wilson's prayer for a miracle, but they get a miracle at the end of the day. I like that. Harvey Keitel being like, yeah, we'll let you kill the Seaside Strangler. I want to torture him. all right, but let's, I think no is the best way. Mostly because of everything, right? No, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's everything on Mixed Nuts. Nothing else that you want to make sure that we say before we send this one away, right?
No, it's starting to snow outside. The plows are going by. It's going to be a dark, cold night out here. I'm glad I have Mixed Nuts to look forward to, because I am going to make sure the family sees this one.
Cashews, chestnuts. Freaking Filberts. Filberts are good nuts if we're a Mixed Nut setup. Excellent. So that's been Mixed Nuts, and this has been Season 4 of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. The season for the fans. I'd like to take one brief moment, to thank all of the fans who suggested films, who helped populate everything that we looked at this season. Seriously, thank you so much for reaching out. Everybody who contacted via email, via Twitter, or just like ran us down at a party and were like, this is what you need to talk about. We're always listening and know that the movies that you talk about, the ones you want to hear, we do hear what you're saying. And with that, thank you again, eternal thank you. Thank you to anyone who suggested anything. Hopefully we got to your suggestions. If not, there's a whole lot out there, right? This is our 26th Adam Sandler film that we've looked at out of 50, I believe. He has at least 50 on IMDb. So we're halfway there, guys, right? Living on a prayer. Playing ukulele, cause it accentuates my hands. So this seems like the perfect time to tell everybody what season 5 is going to be about. And Seijin, why don't you tell people the theme for season 5?
Remakes, redos, retouches, requels. We're just doing anything that Sandler thought could do that better and did it himself.
It's reboot season on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. So season 5, it's going to be the reboot. Maybe we'll reboot the structure of the show. I doubt it, but who knows, right? It's a reboot season. That's what season 5 is all about.
See if we can finally get Jonah Hill and Michael Cera to team back up again and just play us going forward.
The problem with that casting is I don't know who portrays who, Seijin. That's where it always breaks.
The fans know.
Oh, I think the fans do know, Seijin, and I don't think you'd like the answer. I feel like we've reached a point of contention. No. So that's it. So season 5, it's the reboot season of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Reboots, remakes, and all that jazz. And there's one movie that I think you have to start with if you're going to be looking at the remakes, reboots, and everything that Adam Sandler has ever done. And that is 2001's Mr. Deeds. The remake of Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. Is that the name of the original film?
Mr. Deed goes to Washington. No, Mr. Deed Goes to Town, I believe, is the original name of the movie. Yes, we'll have better info next month, though.
Yeah, I put so much effort into Mixed Nuts. It's been crazy, everything I've done for this film, because it felt like such a wall to have to climb to get to make sure that we were doing the fans right on this particular viewing of this film and what it means and what it stands for. So yeah, so if you want to be prepared and studied for next month, make sure you watch Mr. Deeds. I know I'm excited to revisit it because I haven't seen it since that awkward movie date that I went on in the summer of 2001 to go see Mr. Deeds.
I'm so excited to hear that. This is... Well, we'll talk about it next month.
Yeah,
I am excited to see this movie again, and I'm excited to hear you seeing it for the second time.
Whew, man, stranger things have never happened before on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you would liked what we've done here, we release every month. It's usually like the closest Friday to the 9th because we want to honor Adam Sandler's birthday of September 9th. So you're probably listening to this on Adam Sandler's 56¼ birthday, December 9th when it drops. So there you go. If you like us speaking on one hyper-specific topic, namely the films of Adam Sandler. And let's be honest, we went on a little bit more tangents on this Grain of Sandler episode. You probably like our other podcast, The Say Report. That's available wherever fine podcasts are found. And that releases every Monday. So if you want more Seijin and Devin, it is out there and you can find it.
Whether you like it or not.
This is where I would give you Seijin's Twitter information if you wanted to contact him directly. But since Twitter is, on its way out.
Blase. Right? Oh, yeah.
Twitter is calling lifesavers because it might jump. And just click it. There's some static on the line. The best place to get in touch with Seijin is on our Twitter, which is @TheASCU. Yeah, so that's it. If you have anything for Seijin, send it there, and he will definitely see it.
Yeah, that's not my personal Twitter, though, so don't expect me to talk about anything but Adam Sandler if you tweet that one. And you can always find Devin @DevinDDecker. You can tweet him about anything.
Yeah, that's true. I will literally talk to you about anything. But let's try to keep it to Mixed Nuts for the rest of December. That or that song Long December by the Counting Crows. I'm a big fan of that particular tune. So that's everything. Thank you so much for stopping by and listening to this. Thank you for being here for the season 4 finale, the season 4 the fans. And remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're @TheASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe @gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.